Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, birds, bees, whales, and turtles all use the Earth's magnetic field to guide their behavior. Now scientists have learned much more about how. But first, bird colony collapses and crop failures. What's happening to life on Earth, and how can we address the changes for long-term sustainability? With us are three experts. Josh Tewsbury is a research professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and director of the Colorado Global Hub, Future Earth. He is executive editor of Anthropocene Journal and co-author of key studies including Increase in Crop Losses Lead to Insect Pests in a Warming Climate and Defaunation Leads to Interaction Deficits, Not Interaction Compensation in an Island Seed Dispersal Network. Curtis Deutsch is Associate Professor of Chemical Oceanography in the School of Oceanography at Washington University. He co-authored the studies Acceleration of Oxygen Decline in Tropical Pacific Over the Past Decades by Aerosol Pollutants. Microbial Functional Diversity Alters the Structure and Sensitivity of Oxygen Deficient Zones, and Increase in Crop Losses to Insect Pests in a Warming Climate. Stephen Bessinger is Professor of Conservation Biology in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at the University of California, Berkeley. He's co-author of the studies Mojave Desert Bird Populations Plummet as Region Warms and Dries, and The Push and Pull of Climate Change Causes Heterogeneous Shifts in Avian Elevation Ranges. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here with us to talk about the effects of climate change and what you're seeing in each of your studies. I thought a good place to always start is putting your studies into kind of a broader context. One of the things I understand is happening is a mass extinction. I've read that it's something like 25,000 species per year. Is that an accurate number? Joshua, why don't you start us?
I mean, I think what we can clearly say is that the rate of extinctions we're experiencing today is, you know, far exceeds by orders of magnitude what we would consider background rates of extinction that have existed before large-scale human impact on the planet, before the Industrial Revolution. And yet, you know, the exact number of extinctions, I don't have that at the tip of my tongue. I think it's hard to actually estimate. It's not a sustainable number. I think we can agree on that.
Steve Bessinger, what would you add?
Yeah, it's hard to estimate the exact number that disappear a year. If we took you to the morgue, which would be our museums of natural history, we could probably show you maybe about 1,500 species that have disappeared, maybe 2,000 that have disappeared since, you know, over the last 400 or 500 years. But we don't know. We know that some species are disappearing before we're even getting a chance to describe them. And even at that rate, we're talking about, you know, 4 or 5 species a year instead of maybe 1 to 2, which is what we might expect in the background kind of level of extinction. So we know that we are approaching a much more elevated level of extinction now. And a lot of those have been activities, I think, that have been related to changes in habitat. They've been related to over-harvesting of species. They've been related to introduced species that we've moved around the globe. And this last bit, climate change, well, we haven't seen it yet, but it's coming down the pike at us pretty big.
Can I just add one thing to what Steve was saying there, which is just to build on that idea of the impact of climate change on species extinction? I think it's important to note that the causes of species extinction today are, for the most part, more proximate than climate change. In other words, land conversion, habitat loss, huge drivers of species extinction today. But all of the models that, you know, we're working with suggest that the effect of climate change on the ability of species to persist will rise, you know, exponentially through time. It's not, you know, that we're going to see a much greater impact of climate change on species extinction as we move forward.
Curtis, anything you'd like to add?
Well, we have a paper on mass extinction in the geologic record that would support what Josh just said.
Can you say a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, so we've been studying mass extinction in the oceans, in particular during the biggest mass extinction event in Earth history, the end of the Permian. And what we find is that the same patterns of temperature and oxygen change in the past that we're seeing now can account for something like 50% of the rates of extinction that happened back then. And we can also use that to calibrate sort of the expectations for extinction risk going forward. And over the next couple of centuries, we will expect to see, you know, at least a quarter of the levels of extinction that the Permian brought about in the oceans.
So let's now bring it to some of your individual studies. Now, I understand that when you lose a species, it really has an effect on the other species. And I think that's one of the things, Joshua, I think you've done in the past too, is like these interspecies relationships as well. So if we lose something from a habitat or from an ecosystem, there are ramifications to that. Is there a way that you can translate this for people like me to understand?
One of the easiest ways to think about it is that a lot of species have some level of linkage. So a flower depends on its pollinators to some degree. A tree species oftentimes depends also perhaps on the organisms that disperse its seed. And one of the easiest ways in which one extinction can bring on another is that when, as those linkages become tight, the loss of the partner has a strong negative impact on the other species in that is connected to it. And it's the exception that it's one-to-one. It's very rare in the general terms that one species is dependent on its existence on one other. But that doesn't stop the potential of what we would call extinction cascades from taking place when you remove many parts of an ecosystem. And the thing that climate change is doing is forcing organisms to move or adapt, and their ability to move is not equal. And their constraints, their abiotic constraints, their ability to sort of survive in a place as the conditions change, varies. And so that will separate in space or in time organisms that work together to promote each other's existence. So that's, you know, in general terms, how one species can cause the extinction of another.
Well, so Steve, let's bring you into this. I know you looked at the desert in particular, and the collapse of certain bird species in the desert. Can you talk about first why the desert was important? You talked about how it actually gives us an idea of something we might be seeing in the future. And then tell us what you observed.
Sure. So we've been retracing the footsteps of Joseph Grinnell, the first director of the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology here on campus at UC Berkeley. And he went all around the state of California and some other parts of the West about a century ago, dragging his students, making them all take notes and collect specimens of the birds and mammals of the region. And in essence, this was an early biological survey. He recognized the value of what he was doing, and he was hoping that it would be preserved for the student of the future, and that was us. So we've been retracing his footsteps, resurveying, and we started throughout the Sierra Nevadas and spent 7 or 8 years going up and down the Sierras, and have been in the Mojave Desert in some of the more extreme environments we have in North America, Death Valley National Park, Joshua Tree National Monument, Mojave National Preserve. These are places that are protected from land use change, but they're unprotected from climate change. So the climate has been changing in those areas, and they are extreme environments. So I think if you look at the globe and you see where a lot of climate change has occurred, probably two of the hotspots have been on the Arctic. It's been changing very rapidly in terms of heating up and changing the interactions of species there. And then in a lot of the arid areas, interestingly, the hot desert areas. And so we were curious as to what would happen in this extreme environment. And so we've been resurveying the birds and the mammals. The mammal work isn't quite done yet, but the birds have shown us a kind of an interesting sign of a community collapse taking place there. So the baseline that we have is a century ago. Compared to that, out of 135 species of birds, we've only had one species that has increased over that time, and about a third of them, almost a third, have declined in that region. And the only winner is the common raven, a very smart, adaptable bird that can find food in different places and fly great distances to find water. Within the desert community, what we saw was probably the best descriptor of change was a change in precipitation. Places that dried out more, not just heated, but dried, were the ones that showed the greatest decline. And these are locations, even in our protected areas that were showing these large declines in the numbers of birds there.
So you had said it was a bellwether. The desert was a bellwether. So what can we draw from your study now, showing us these collapses and then one survivor that is doing well? What is this telling us?
Well, so the desert's an extreme environment, right? And so it's a tough place for life. And in a certain way, it's interesting because it's showing us that there, unless you're highly adapted to that desert environment, you might not be able to survive well. And there's not a set of fauna, there's not a set of species to come in and backfill behind it. In other environments, we kind of expect, well, the warming or drying, it's going to favor some species, disfavor other species. It's going to change their relationships. It'll be the extreme environments that'll probably hit first and the hardest.
Curtis, you looked at tropical environments?
Well, in the study that Josh and I did with co-authors, we looked at how to estimate global scale losses of crop production from increasing metabolic rates of insect pests. And that did include the tropics, indeed. Although, perhaps more importantly, it was the more temperate climates where a lot of our grains are produced that saw the biggest projected increases in insect pest pressure, that is the loss of our crop yields to insects.
Why does a hotter environment generate this metabolism on the insects? Joshua.
Well, I just wanted to make a quick connection to what Steve was saying to make the link, because Curtis and I have done a couple of papers together. And I think the first one we did is really focused on some of the same work that Steve was doing and really understanding how climate change impacts biodiversity. And it is really the backbone of the current paper we did on crops. And so what we were looking at in that first paper was the relationship. I mean, there's a couple of forces going on when you think about the very broadest patterns of impacts of climate change on biodiversity when it comes to physiological tolerance to change. We exist in a band of temperature in which we are healthy, and animals have the same, and plants have the same, and they can breed in that range, and outside of it, they can't, and they tend to not exist in that range. So what we were looking at in that first paper was the fact that in temperate zones, because it's a fairly seasonal environment, animals tend to exhibit, in this case, we worked on animals, tend to exhibit a broad range of tolerance to temperature. When it gets cold, they can deal with that to some extent. When it gets warm, they can deal with that to some extent because they exist in a variable environment. So you have to have that quality. In the tropics, it's quite consistent in temperature throughout the year. And what you see is a lot of animals have narrower tolerances to change. And what we were exploring is, does it then follow that the same amount of change of temperature in the tropics will have a bigger impact as it will in the temperate zone, simply because they're just not as able to change, you know, to that because of that temperature. And we found that, you know, the evidence generally supports that. Even though there may be greater change in the temperate zones, for a given amount of change, it'll have a greater impact on a physiological and potentially reproductive impact in the tropics. That forms the backbone of our work in this paper, because it's getting warmer in both cases. And when it gets warmer in the tropics, there's not a lot of organisms adapted to that warmer environment. There's not like a place where they come into, as Steve was saying, there's no backfilling necessarily. You know, you can think of it, you know, organisms can move from a warmer, lower environment up a mountainside. But what moves into that valley? Well, there is no lower, warmer environment to fill that. And yet when you're in the temperate zone and it gets warmer, there is, you know, in very general senses, a suite of organisms that exist in warmer environments that either can move north, or organisms that can take advantage of the warmer temperature, because the temperate zone has a whole bunch of time periods when it's not necessarily a good time to be alive as an insect, for example. We call that winter, right? Where it's there's not a lot of bugs around. And so as we warm the temperature, some organisms may actually benefit. I think I want to turn to you, Curtis, to sort of keep going on that, because I just wanted to fill out sort of that the backbone. And I think I didn't quite make the link as well as I could have. So if you want to keep going.
No, I think you have summarized one of the major dynamics that underlies the prediction about what happens to crop yields. And that is that in climates that are today relatively cool, the temperate zone, let's say, where we produce most of the grain, we would expect the warming to actually increase the population growth rate of most insects, whereas in the tropics, it may reduce that growth rate. There's a second piece, which is that no matter where you are, most insects will tend to burn more calories as you increase the temperature of the environment. And so that's sort of the more simple uniform pattern, that everything will start to eat more. All these ectothermic insects will begin to eat more if there's food available, simply because the temperature of their environment is warmer and their biochemical reactions are going faster and they're burning more energy and they need to eat more to compensate for that. So you put those two things together what you find is sort of a double whammy in the cooler climates, where you have more insects or they're growing faster and they're also eating more. And in the tropics, you have kind of a compensating effects where they may be eating more, but their populations are reproducing not as fast. And so the unfortunate side of that, of course, is that it's the areas where you have the double whammy that produce most of the grain for the world, with a possible exception of rice, but certainly for wheat and corn. Those are grown in areas where the insects are probably going to be increasing in number and in their overall rate of food consumption. And of course, that comes at the expense of the people who plant and would like to eat the food.
As you were talking, I was thinking about the connection between birds dying out and greater numbers of insect. It was a question you sort of posed in that article, Josh and Curtis, which was about sustainable insect management, right? So I was thinking, if we're having these collapse of birds in the deserts, would they be moving into these areas where there's much more food for them, for example?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know exactly what's happened with the individual species or we don't know if their species are no longer returning to some of those sites, or they're just returning but just not reproducing and managing to have sustain local populations. That's probably more likely what's happening. This is a pretty big region, the Mojave Desert. A lot of the bird species that we were working with were not specialized. They were widespread in other parts of North America. The desert specialists tended to reduce in their occurrence less frequently or less of a magnitude, but they still were declining there. So I don't know. And it's very interesting what kind of knock-on effects will happen in that ecosystem described by, you know, these last two studies we were just talking about. Yeah, we don't know. And I think those are places that we need to probe now and see what's happening.
Steve, I mean, one of the things that I really, really loved about your work, the work that you guys have done retracing Grinnell's steps, was, you know, how the lack of ability, when you look at how organisms moved up and down elevations, for example, the predictability of that was much lower than one might have expected.
And oh my gosh, yes.
It's one of these really striking findings that, you know, you expect organisms to move to warmer, you know, as it gets warmer, to move to cooler climates up in elevation. And that's how we expect sort of communities to move. But it doesn't work that way. And I think it's worth just saying a bit about that, because it just speaks to the lack of our ability to predict the precise nature of species movements.
Yeah, it's humbled us thinking about this problem, because when we were working in the Sierras, and we spent 7-8 years doing that, doing these 3,000-meter elevational transects, and we expected exactly that signal you talk about, species moving upslope, and we saw it initially in one general area. But then when we started looking more broadly, we found some parts of the montane regions in California, we had more species moving downslope. Other areas, they weren't moving much at all. the same species was doing different things in all three areas. In fact, that was more common than anything else.
How so dare they?
Yeah, exactly. And it told
They're
us
not behaving.
A lot more. Yeah, well, and precipitation was part of the driver in there too, right? Because it's not just, you know, temperature. And so the last bit about that we were kind of exploring more recently is this question of whether species can actually move by staying in the same place, but timing all their events earlier. You know, if it's getting warmer and they're having to experience this changing environment, could they just shift their schedules a week or two earlier to keep up with the climate and then be in that same kind of climate zone? And to some degree, we've seen some of that kind of signal in the birds from the Grinnell resurvey work. But Josh, you're giving us a little bit too much credit because we're really good at connecting two dots together. The old Grinnell time and our modern time with a straight line. And we know
That's
it's
right.
going to be more complicated than that.
Fair enough.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about bird colony collapses and crop failures. What's happening to life on Earth, and how can we address the changes for long-term sustainability?
That sort of shifting in time that you mentioned, Steve, it sounded also like, Joshua, you and Curtis in your study were also talking about a shifting in time, but with relation to how we deal with feeding the world and what that's going to mean in the future with these increased pests eating the food and how to deal with that as a humanity, really, since different crops were in different temperatures. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to which foods are we going to be dealing with the most problems and what that might mean in terms of those seasonal shifts.
Well, I have some fragmented thoughts on it, and I'm sure you'll put them together more nicely. But I mean, one of the things is that when you start to have climates that change in somewhat unpredictable ways, farmers rely on some degree of predictability in a climate. So they need to know when it's safe to plant so that they don't lose their crop. I was back in Iowa a few years ago where I grew up, and my grandparents' farm was being farmed by someone else now. And, you know, it was a little bit before April and it was a beautiful spring. And he said, you know, I wish I could go out there and plant right now because it seems like it's going to be a great year, but I can't because the insurance company won't insure my crop unless I plant it after April 1st. And then sure enough, about 3 weeks later, I was back home in Seattle and Iowa was hit by a huge flooding event. So it's a good thing he didn't plant early. But the point of the story is just that that sort of unpredictability, where the past is no longer a good predictor of sort of, you know, spring transition and things like that in the climate, adds a high degree of uncertainty that generally doesn't work in the favor of predictable production of food. And, you know, the plants are going to have their own sort of responses to the timing of spring melt and rain and thawing and all of that stuff. So I think that just that sort of unpredictability is a major factor in all of it.
Joshua, did you want to add?
One of the things about our most recent paper is that it's a very general model. So we picked three major food grains to explore. But, you know, our model isn't about rice, wheat, and maize or corn. It's about how insects are going to change in their ability to consume our crops and how that impact will vary across latitude. And so there's nothing in the model about rice per se, except the amount of damage that rice gets today. And then we use that as a base point to predict the future, which means that, you know, it's not just about these grains, but it's about apple orchards. It's about grapes. It's about any place where you have a strong insect population, you know, that is competing with us for the food that we use to feed the world. And what our model suggests is that, you know, if you're doing that in a temperate latitude. If you're doing that in places like France or places like Belgium or in the wheat belt of Canada and the U.S., even in the corn belt in the U.S., that these areas are likely to undergo significant negative changes in terms of the amount of pressure they're going to be facing from insect pests. And in some cases and in some countries, it's a doubling of insect pest pressure over the next 40 years. And that changes the equation significantly for farmers in terms of how they respond and what their profit margins look like. And it does so unevenly around the world. So it's both a competitive issue about where we can grow things effectively and efficiently and which countries can actually, become those breadbaskets for the world. And it's also an issue that, knocks onto a lot of other things we care about, because food production does take up so much of the world already. And one of the challenges we face in a growing populations with increasing numbers of people eating higher on the food chain is, where do you grow that food? And how do you grow it in a way that's efficient and resilient to a changing environment? And how do you do it also in a way that allows us to combat things like climate change? Because we're going to need more and more area just to put carbon back into the ground. And how do you do all of those things in a way that doesn't, push our production into the last bastions of biodiversity, which are, the places where we could grow crops but are currently not, because thankfully we've set them aside for biodiversity. These are the things we wrestle with. And I think what our paper says is, we're still kind of underestimating the potential impacts. Before our work, we already recognized that climate change was going to reduce yields. And what our paper says is we significantly underestimated the amount by which it would reduce yields.
It sounded like with the international report that came out that we've sort of underestimated everything with what climate change is going to bring. That sort of puts us into this conversation about the politics of science, the policies that need to be in place, and the leadership in the United States, of course, will affect all of us all over the world. Now, Joshua, I know you're involved with Future Earth. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of background about Future Earth and its efforts to deal with climate science and the politics of science.
The simplest way of thinking about what our role is that there's a tremendous amount of innovation and research going on around the world in research institutions globally. And what we try and do is help that research have a stronger voice in policy and practice communities and help to focus the many thousands of researchers working on global change issues and support the kind of science that we can elevate to a dialogue or a public stage that will influence policymakers. For example, understanding how much carbon is in the atmosphere is not done by one scientist. It's done by scientists all over the world. Someone has to get together to collect that and then publish that work. That's one of our global projects that does that work. And then, someone has to make sure that when that paper comes out, it's not just read by the scientific community, but it has the maximum impact in the policy community. So let's time that right before the what we call the COP, or the Conference of Parties for the climate COP. And then let's put the kind of strategic science involved so we can engage policymakers around how to interpret those results from one year to the next. Are we leveling? Are we increasing climate emissions? A lot of our work is around that kind of sort of understanding how to put science together in a more integrative way and how to make it happen in a way that involves decision communities. And most of the focus is on the Sustainable Development Goals and how we engage science more effectively as a part of that social process. If we're moving towards this transformation that we all need to see in all sectors of society, what can science offer and how we might get there? So that's the basic mode of what Future Earth does: try to set better narratives, try to engage science in a collective, in collections that aren't currently engaged. And one of the things that we find is that we tend to do a lot of disciplinary work rather well, because we've been training scientists in disciplines for a long time. We don't have that history in understanding how to put the pieces together effectively across disciplines and also with societal partners. And that's not because some scientists do it naturally, but it's not in our training and it's not in our incentive structures. So we try and create supports and incentives and trainings and to help create those more integrative teams of scientists working across disciplines that can help address these problems, which almost inherently are cross-disciplinary, whether it's a food systems problem or a water availability or a climate problem. pretty quickly you recognize that you don't just need the models, the biophysical models, you also need the social pathway models and the social systems models. And that requires communication. So that's basically what we do.
Well, given what the latest reports have said, that we've been underestimating the impacts of climate change, do you think that Future Earth and related organizations of scientists are going to have to change their strategy?
Well, I think all of us will. But I think universities in general have both a prerogative and an immediate mandate and need to shift modes so that discovery communities can more effectively engage with decision maker communities, and so that we can work more effectively as cross-disciplinary teams. You know, the academic institutions of today were set up basically mostly, you know, to respond to the Industrial Revolution when we needed to create strong members of society, but they weren't set up to effectively deal with these inherently cross-disciplinary problems. And so our incentive structures don't necessarily work for us today. We do need to change that. And there are lots of communities working to do that, both at the individual lab level, at the departmental level, occasionally at the university level, where leadership really recognizes the need to break down barriers between disciplines to have problem-focused programs. So yeah, there's a lot of need for change, but it's not just academic communities that need to change. It's also very much in, you know, how we reach out into the policy space and engage those communities and help them create the change as well.
And then how do you deal with policymakers who actively reject the scientific evidence? I think this is something both you and Steve, you've talked about this a little bit as well. At least I've seen you quoted in some pieces where you've talked about, you know, what we're dealing with when we have collapsing bird colonies and climate increasing insects and more droughts and floods and really threatening the existence of multiple living beings.
Nature's gotten over the argument about whether climate is changing or not. They're voting with their feet. The climate's changing, right? So it's not a question. The word belief is often used, I find, in this context, and it's a pretty inappropriate word. So the question is, oftentimes why I think there's people who are fighting against this perspective, and what do we have to offer as scientists for it? I think Josh made a good point that we are seeing now a change in how science has been trying to respond to climate. It's much more multidisciplinary. We have many more collaborations as scientists with all kinds of people. And Future Earth is a great example of different types of scientists coming together. But it's happening. I think it is kind of happening from the ground up in its own way. And so how you deal with the politics of that with it is somewhat, I think, depends on the community you're trying to communicate with. I find it still a challenge in some communities to make sure that they understand that the preponderance of evidence is primarily on one side of the argument of whether climate is changing or not. But then we've got to move well beyond that now.
Especially when you have leaders who have decision-making power that, you know, refuse to accept the science.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, from my perspective, it's often probably motivations of sort of follow the money. Sad to say.
The good news on that is that so many of the transitions that we need are going to happen no matter what some of these leaders say.
That's right.
You know, like, we're so far down the road of you know, renewable energies becoming cost effective and efficient to take over from fossil fuels that it really doesn't matter too much about what the federal government of the U.S. does. Mm-hmm. That energy transition is out of the gate. It's going to happen. I mean, it's going to happen, and it'll radically change the way we, you know, way we acquire energy and use energy. And that's a really positive force. So I think picking up on those positive forces is really important. One of the things that we did was, you know, what we were very involved in what was called the GCAS Summit, which was California taking leadership on climate where, you know, the U.S. had not. And that brought together leaders from around the world. China sent a huge delegation to that, for example. And we mapped out a roadmap. Like, how does each sector have to change to have carbon emissions every decade? That's what we have to do. We have to do it every decade. And it's a challenge, but it's not undoable. And there are maps we can build, science-based maps to say, here's what each sector can contribute to this change. And here's how we can get there. And you have to then play that out in with the private sector. I mean, we did that with executives from Intel and other tech companies, you know, to really build the right sort of constituency for the message. I think that kind of work can have impact in spite of what individual leaders are doing to drag the feet of their own economy. I mean, fundamentally, the biggest loser in pulling out of the climate accords for the U.S. was the U.S. It's not actually going to stop the climate accord. But the Trump's moves to pull us out is, it's hurting our ability. I mean, the U.S. could easily have been a leader in the green economy and still has potential, but we're shooting ourselves in the foot by dragging our feet in this way.
Curtis has been very quiet for a long time. Curtis, do you have anything you'd want to add to this?
These guys have said a lot of stimulating things. I guess I would maybe just, my mind was drawn back to the beginning of the conversation and this notion of current extinction rates, even before the real onset of the major climate changes we're expecting in this century, being well above their baseline levels. And so even if tomorrow we got rid of the climate problem, we still have some serious ecosystem disruption that goes on. And I think we have to view those things, in my mind, as part of a whole. And to me, that whole is just that we really have to think seriously about an appropriate balance between, you know, human activity on the planet and space for the rest of life to exist. So I feel most compelled by solutions to the climate problem that attempt to view that as part of a bigger project of, you know, maintaining the integrity of ecosystems globally.
Steve Bessinger?
I think those were some really good thoughts, Curtis, and I agree totally. We're trying to put this into a perspective of a broader effort on sustainability, and we can get there. I do think that a lot of people, as Joshua said, I think there's a lot of momentum in this direction. There's also friction. And our goal is to figure out ways to reduce that friction within society. And as scientists, you know, it's through these kinds of collaborations that I think are helping to push our understanding of the consequences further along.
Joshua Tewksbury.
I completely agree with both Steve and Curtis were saying. And I think particularly just the idea that sustainability is something that we need to support within the sciences, and that you can be a chemist and be a sustainability scientist, and you can be a sociologist and be a sustainability scientist, and you can be an economist and also contribute towards this goal. And that increasingly we need to support that union of disciplines like we support the disciplines themselves, because we just simply don't have enough time not to do it that way. We have a huge lift, and the discovery and the innovation communities that exist in academia are going to be essential to getting us through this. We need to work as the strongest team possible around the world to do that.
Well, I thank the three of you very much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. It's been a really great pleasure to host you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Josh Tewksbury is a research professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and director of the Colorado Global Hub, Future Earth. He is executive editor of Anthropocene Journal and co-author of key studies including Increase in Crop Losses Lead to Insect Pests in a Warming Climate and Defaunation Leads to Interaction Deficits, Not Interaction Compensation in an Island Seed Dispersal Network. Curtis Deutsch is associate professor of chemical oceanography in the School of Oceanography at Washington University. He co-authored the studies Acceleration of Oxygen Decline in Tropical Pacific Over the Past Decades by Aerosol Pollutants. Microbial Functional Diversity Alters the Structure and Sensitivity of Oxygen Deficient Zones, and Increase in Crop Losses to Insect Pests in a Warming Climate. Stephen Bessinger is professor of conservation biology in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at the University of California, Berkeley. He's co-author of the studies Mojave Desert Bird Populations Plummet as Region Warms and Dries, and The Push and Pull of Climate Change Causes Heterogeneous Shifts in Avian Elevation Ranges.
When we come back, birds, bees, whales, and turtles all use the Earth's magnetic field to guide them in their behavior. Now scientists have learned much more about how. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Birds, bees, whales, and turtles all use the Earth's magnetic field to guide them in their behavior. Scientists have learned much more about how. With us is Andres Vidal-Gadea. He is a professor of molecular neuroethology at Illinois State University and has made fascinating discoveries. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Andres Vidal-Gadea. It's great to have you here. This research that you've done related to the magnetic field of the Earth and how all these species use it, quite fascinating. Your article starts with sort of a broad stroke about the purpose of the magnetic field itself for the Earth, but also for the animals. Do you think we could start for our listeners with a bit of Earth Magnetic Field 101?
Yes. The inside of the Earth is made of molten material, and this is turning all the time, and pretty much like an engine is generating huge magnetic field that expands far into space. This magnetic field, as far as we know, protects life on Earth from harmful radiation from the sun. And it also provides a very constant and reliable cue for navigation that animals can use to orient themselves.
Different kinds of animals use this. We know birds use the magnetic field to orient themselves when they migrate. What else? What are the other animals that use it?
Animals like bees, for example, and animals like mole rats, mammals, especially migratory animals like the birds and like whales and other organisms use the magnetic field. In fact, it was only because we weren't looking before that we didn't see how many species are capable of using the Earth's magnetic field to navigate. I originally got started on this on a sea slug that lives in the bottom of the sea and apparently uses the magnetic field to find its way around. So these things are all around us.
So do you suspect, as the scientists studying this, that really all species rely on the magnetic field as a source of information?
I don't think that all species perhaps use the magnetic field, but I think that the list is probably much greater than we anticipated. One of the things that I was very surprised to find out was, well, initially that these tiny little worms that live in the soil will care about the magnetic field, because normally people think of larger, more mobile organisms using the magnetic field. That kind of opened the possibility that maybe there are all kinds of little animals in the ground that are using the magnetic field all the time, and we didn't pay attention to it before. I think that, in my mind at least, animals that need to navigate in their environment are the ones that may use it, especially animals that, like the worms that live in an environment that is devoid of other kind of sensory information, perhaps. They can use the magnetic field to help them find their way around.
So birds, of course, butterflies, bees, you mentioned whales. Your article mentioned wolves. How would wolves even detect the magnetic field?
There are a couple of ways in which people believe animals can detect the magnetic field. One of them relies on tiny little intracellular magnets inside certain cells of organisms. And this is certainly the case for some bacteria, and people have identify these particles in bees and in other animals. The second way that people believe animals can detect the magnetic field is with some specialized photoreceptors in their eyes. And this applies to many birds and other species. The idea here is that perhaps a photoreceptor cell in their eye, in the retina of these birds or animals, may be able to see the magnetic field just like we can see color, and from that inform the animal which way they need to go. And so I think that in the case of the wolf and other mammals that people looked at, that's the idea that right now they have. But this is one of the things, right? We can do experiments that inform us that an organism can orient to magnetic fields, but it's a very different thing to find out where the cells that detect the magnetic field or how these animals are actually detecting. That's what makes it really difficult. And that's one of the things that the little worm we work with comes in really handy, because it only has 1,000 cells altogether. So it makes it a lot easier to hunt.
Let's talk about what you found and how you conducted the experiment. You wanted to see how this worm operates with the magnetic field. So you used a means of manipulating the magnetic field. Why don't you tell us the process, and then let's talk about what you've discovered.
Sure. Originally, it was a very simple idea. I came across an article where some scientists have indicated that they found these tiny magnetic particles inside the worm. And having been working with this as an undergraduate, I was thinking, well, if they have these tiny particles in there, maybe they can detect the magnetic field. So the first experiment that I did was simply to put a magnet next to a plate which had worms in it. And after a few minutes, we noticed that the worms went towards the magnet. And right then and there, we realized, wow, these animals can definitely tell that it's a magnet over there. So after that, we tried to be more sophisticated. So we built a magnetic cage. And this is just a box that allows us to control the magnetic field within it. So we can dial any kind of magnetic field that we want. And sure enough, we started testing the animals in there. And we noticed that in this magnetic cage, the worms didn't just go along with the magnetic field, but they rather chose a particular direction to it. And once we started thinking about why will these worms go at a particular angle to the magnetic field, and after a while of scratching our head, we looked at where these worms came from, and we realized these worms came from England. And if these worms were in England, in the soil, the direction that they were going to the magnet was the same direction that would take them up or down in the soil if they were migrating to the earth field in England.
You had Australian worms, you had British worms, you had Hawaiian worms,
yes,
and you had equatorial worms. And yes, they all did different things, which is, I think, quite fascinating. Can you walk us through?
Sure, yeah. So most of the, if you think of an animal that can orient to the magnetic field, the great majority of animals, people immediately will think of birds that migrate north or they migrate south. These are animals that are moving horizontally, so to speak, in the environment. Now, the magnetic field, it has a horizontal component, and we use it to go north, east, west. These are the directions that we are familiar with. But the magnetic field also has an angle to it, to the ground. And so you could imagine the magnetic field being perpendicular to the soil if you were in the North Pole or in the South Pole, and being horizontal or parallel to the soil if you were in the equator. And we knew there were worms isolated from all parts of the world. There are worms isolated from something like 100 countries. And so we could easily get a hold of these animals and bring them to a lab, and then we test them. So the idea was the following. If the worms use the magnetic field like a bird to migrate horizontally, then worms from the equator should be able to do this no problem, because in the equator the magnetic field is horizontal to the, and parallel to the ground. However, if worms use the magnetic field to go up and down, then worms from the equator may not be able to do this, because in the equator, the magnetic field is not vertical. And this is exactly what we found. We found that worms that were close to the equator did not really orient to the magnetic field, but worms that were from the northern parts of the world, like Canada and England, they did this very well. And worms that were from the southern hemisphere, like Australia, were also able to do this. The trick is that in the north hemisphere, the magnetic field is pointing down, with the north pointing down, while in the southern hemisphere, the magnetic field, the north is pointing up. And so the polarity is reversed. And according to that, we also saw that Australian worms were moving at the opposite direction than British worms would.
You also noticed that if they were hungry, they reacted differently.
Yes, and this gave me a huge headache at first, because the first assay that the first time I did this assay, it worked beautifully, and all the worms went towards the magnet. And then I tried to do it again, and then they went away for the magnet. And I was trying to understand why sometimes the worms will go one way and sometimes they will go the other way. Clearly, they could tell there was a magnet there, because otherwise they would just go in random directions. But in this case, they knew, but they were just trying to confuse me. And it took a while to realize that it would only take 15 minutes for a nice and happy, well-fed worm to start to feel hungry. And at that point, they decided to go the opposite direction. And so once we figured this out, then it was easier to do the experiments. But for a while, we just didn't know what was going on there.
So you had to starve some worms.
Yes. So eventually we decided to either run the assays with the animals that were just out of the food and immediately into the assay, or we could choose to just put them away from food for 15, 30 minutes and then run the assay, and that did the trick, right? And then the worms will consistently go either towards the magnet or away from the magnet, and depending on whether they were hungry or starved. And of course, we didn't know why they would do that, and it wasn't until we measured where the worms were from and the angle at which the magnetic field enters the Earth in England, that we realized that, in fact, what they were doing was kind of going in an upwards direction if they were well-fed, and in a downwards direction if they were hungry. So we don't understand exactly why that is, but it looks like if the worms are hungry, they tend to burrow down into the soil, and when they are well-fed, they tend to burrow upwards towards the surface.
Has there been research that ties humanity to magnetic field effects?
There have been some preliminary studies trying to see, you mean, to find out if humans can detect the magnetic field or affected by it.
Yeah, and if we're just disoriented because we're from the United States but living in New Zealand, for example.
Right. Well, people have put humans in big, dark warehouses, and they have had kind of conflicting results. So it hasn't been consistently proven or disproven that the humans can detect the magnetic field. I can tell you that some of these magnetic particles that we find in all these animals that detect magnetic fields, people have found those in the brain of humans as well. And some of these receptors that birds have and some of the molecules that people believe are implicated in seeing the magnetic field in the case of birds, they have found some of these in humans as well. So I think that we have the hardware to do this. Now, whether we do it, I don't know. And it could be a combination of things, right? Mostly modern humans, we are extremely good with our eyes and finding our way around using our sense of vision. And for the most part, we don't really need to migrate great distances anymore anyway, like a bird or a turtle may have to in the ocean. We're pretty much set, and we don't engage in this huge migration. So perhaps we have it, and we just haven't had to use it for a long time.
Finally, I was wondering as I was reading your paper about whether or not technological changes that humans have made, if they alter the ability to detect any kind of magnetic force from the Earth because of the use that humanity has put with magnets, like using magnets in all kinds of technological products.
Oh, I think that that is certainly a possibility, and people have started to look into that. I am sad and at the same time happy. I can't see magnetic fields because we definitely surround ourselves with them, and if we could see them, we would probably be blinded by them. People have started to notice that even power lines that also generate any kind of electricity, any wire in your house or in your office that conducts electricity will create a magnetic field. And people have found that power lines are strong enough to confuse migratory birds when they are traveling. There is no telling what subterranean lines can do to the insects and other organisms that live in the soil. So I definitely think that we definitely have the ability to change how animals navigate their environment and how they go about their business by putting out these huge magnetic fields all around us and ever more powerful and more present everywhere, basically.
Where do you think your research is going to go next?
Thanks. And we are at the moment, we have this cell, we discovered the cell that can detect the magnetic field in this little animal. And at the moment we're investigating, I started my lab here at Illinois, and my students are working to find out how does this cell convert magnetic energy into neuronal information. There's got to be some moving parts in this little cell that are transforming one kind of energy into the other. And we believe that possibly the mechanism how this takes place is probably going to be repeated in many other species. So we are looking into that. And another thing that I have some students working on is we want to know what happens if you withdraw the magnetic field from around animals. And, you know, people are trying to make plans to travel far into space and go to Mars, maybe, and that would be far away from the Earth's magnetic field where all life has evolved. And so we are growing animals in a zero magnetic field chamber, and then we're trying to see what genes or what happens to the animal when that takes place.
Andreas Vidal-Gadea, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andres Vidal-Gadea is a professor of molecular neuroethology at Illinois State University and has made fascinating discoveries. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Author and conservationist Rachel Carson.
To understand the shore, it is not enough to catalog its life. Understanding comes only when, standing on a beach, we can sense the long rhythms of earth and sea that sculptured its landform and produced the rock and sand of which it is composed. When we can sense with the eye and ear of the mind the surge of life beating always at its shores, blindly, inexorably, pressing for a foothold. To understand the life of the shore, it is not enough to pick up an empty shell and say, this is a murex, or that is an angel wing. True understanding demands intuitive comprehension of the whole life of the creature that once inhabited this empty shell. How it survived amid surf and storms, what were its enemies, how it found food and reproduced its kind. What were its relations to the particular sea world in which it lived?